This is the audio from a recent Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube video. We've stripped the audio so that you can listen on the go.
The assumption has always been, well, of course, it's the me that wants to go to the gym that represents what I really want. It can't possibly be the me that wants to sleep in and enjoy the pleasure of a Saturday morning. The second point, which is that we can use this to make people do what they actually want to do, I find a bit more, objectionable. It has a deep political message in these essays, which is that if you sort of view the world and you think, well, we know deep down exactly what people want, and that is sort of a path to oppression and wars of religion and totalitarianism.
Hello, friends, wherever you are. Welcome to another episode of The Swift Half with Snowden. I am your host, Christopher Snowden, and we've got another half hour of chat lined up for you. This time it is with Eric Mattson, who's joining us from America down the line. He is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and also the author of this IA book that came out recently. It's actually a collection of essays about behavioral economics, paternalism, and so forth. Eric, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you did in your PhD before we get onto the book?
Yeah, sure. I studied at George Mason, actually. Well, actually, I began as a music major, and then I transferred to George Mason, and I studied economics. And then I rolled from undergraduate studies into the PhD program at George Mason, and I ended up writing a dissertation on Smith and Hume. So my background is in intellectual history and the history of economic thought. So that's my background in economics and intellectual history. I did a postdoc at New York University, and my supervisor was a professor named Mario Rizzo, who, along with Glenn Whitman, has written, I think, really the definitive critique of some of the new paternalism. And so he sort of got me onto the subject and encouraged me to apply some of my background in intellectual history to some of these policy issues and some philosophical issues with the new paternalism. So after NYU, I ended up actually back in the George Mason sphere. I now work at the Mercatus Center, which is a research center that works very closely with the Department of Economics. And I help run a program on Adam Smith, actually, in the Department of Economics.
Fantastic. And I agree with you about Escaping Paternalism. I read it when it came out. It's really good.
Yeah. It's a wonderful book. For those viewers who are interested in taking a deep dive on these topics, that's really the place to begin, I think.
Yeah, my approach to the behavioral economics stuff was always that it was quite interesting, but also fairly trivial, even if it was benign. And in terms of practical recommendations, there seem to be very few policies that you could conjure up that would actually fit within the quite rigid boundaries that Thaler and Sunstein put forward in that book, Nudge. And in fact, there were quite a few hard paternalists in Britain who got quite excited when the book came out in 2008, I think it was, because I guess it had the word paternalism in it. And then when they read it, they thought, oh, actually, this is no good to us at all. This is going to mean we're going to have to repeal hundreds of laws and be far less paternalistic in our legislation if we're going to comply with these rules. So how would you define the new paternalism, and how does it differ from traditional paternalism?
So just a brief sort of description of the new paternalism and how it's different from the old paternalism. So, you know, the defining feature of the new paternalism is that it claims to help people better satisfy or realize their own preferences. So the old paternalism, was a kind of open imposition of some notion of the good on others. So you flog somebody until they convert to your religion, or you just simply say, well, alcohol is a known bad, therefore we will not permit you to consume alcohol. And so, of course, in the West, in the modern period at least, there was a turn for a time away from that kind of old paternalism. And there was at least a partial embrace of this idea that we should permit individuals to pursue their interests as they understand them. And society is about sort of building an order that serves the people well, it serves people's interests well. But then in the 1970s, there were some movements in in cognitive psychology and then later in behavioral economics. And this movement was in part spearheaded by the late Daniel Kahneman, who passed away a few weeks ago, and his colleague Amos Tversky. And they drew attention to some difficulties that people have in pursuing their interests in a consistent, rational manner, or at least they claimed to provide some evidence suggesting that people don't actually pursue their interests very well. And from this movement came a growing conviction amongst some psychologists and some behavioral scientists that people are actually not really that rational, and people consistently act in a way that undermines their own interest. And so the new paternalism is about, you know, helping people, supposedly, helping people to do the things that they really want to do by taking advantage of a knowledge that we have of you know, humans' mental equipment, a knowledge that we have of common pitfalls and choice, and sort of structuring choices in a way that helps people do the things that they really actually want to do. And so the nudge program was originally about choice architecture, is the technical word. So regulating or setting up a choice situation so that people are more likely to do the thing that they actually want to do. So, you know, it's claimed, we know that people don't actually want to smoke, but people do smoke. Smoking's addictive. They say, I don't want to smoke, but they continue to smoke. So what if we put pictures on cigarette packages that reminded people of the fact they really don't want to smoke? We're not prohibiting them from smoking, although now we are in some cases. But in theory, we're just reminding them of the fact that they don't actually want to smoke. And so it's a seemingly benign regulation that, you know, builds from a knowledge of our decision-making process that pushes people in the direction that they, in fact, want to go. So that's sort of the broad setup and the idea of the nudge.
What would be the argument against that kind of regulation?
The argument against the cigarette packaging in particular, or just against the
both?
Yeah, well, one argument, and this is sort of a common argument against the nudge regulations. I mean, the deepest argument is that it's actually very hard to know what people want. And many of these policies, I think, end up simply imposing a view of the good on consumers. We know that you don't want to smoke. That's the sort of philosophical critique. We know, and so we're going to remind you of the fact that you don't want to smoke. Because it's, you know, when you get down to it, it's quite difficult to say that people don't want to smoke or people don't want to eat sugar. And if you look closely, it ends up being the case that most of these regulations are simply an imposition of preferences on other people. You know, then there are, of course, economic considerations that don't get so much time of day, you know, compliance costs, for instance, and what that does to consumer and producer surplus. So these are sort of classic economic considerations that have sort of taken a back seat in this discourse. But the real sort of philosophical question and issue is, what do people want? How do we know what they want? And do people really want to do less of the things that we think they want to do less of?
I found one of the more compelling arguments for the sort of nudge agenda to be the idea that the choice architecture, the stuff that does to some extent determine our choices, is inevitable. I mean, there's always going to be choice architecture, and so we're always going to be nudged in one way or another. And so if you take an example of probably the only major nudge mentioned in that book, that was then taken on by the British government, which is workplace pension schemes. Now, most people say they want to save more for their retirement, but a lot of employers don't really want to be paying into it, and so they nudge you away from taking out your workplace pension by having an opt-in system. You know, you have to make a conscious effort to opt in. Theta and Sunstein say if you change that round, then you'll have more people will be signing up for the pension, and you have to make a conscious effort to opt out. Now, that seems to me, that argument about the choice architecture seems to be reasonable, that we are always in some way manipulated and nudged in some way. So given that defaults are inevitable, what is the argument against arranging the architecture in a way that would seem to be consistent with people's preferences.
Yeah, I think, of course, choice architecture is inevitable, and it's important to think about defaults, whether or not you're, you know, in private enterprise or in regulation. So I do think that behavioral economics is useful for formulating regulations. It's useful if you have a goal in mind. It's useful to know how people are going to respond to the framing of the situation. It's useful to know that people are more likely to stick with defaults if you're crafting a regulation. So that's one point. But the second point, which is that we can use this to make people do what they actually want to do, I find a bit more, you know, objectionable. So one of the things about Nudge is when you read the book, the opening situation, the description of choice architecture is about a cafeteria, right? And so it's about, essentially, it seems to be a private operator of a cafeteria making a decision about where to place dessert items. And so, of course, businesses do this all the time. You decide where you'd like to put things. So that's sort of nudging in a private situation, and that's, you know, what people do all the time. The question about, you know, regulation and whether or not we should understand these nudges as sort of just helping people what they in fact themselves want to do, I think that's a more difficult question. And I'm not convinced that nudges are actually doing that. I think they are operating with a kind of folk theory of the good. Well, everybody knows that everybody should save more, therefore we should make it so that people are opted in. And that's fine as far as it goes, but I don't think we should pretend that what we're doing is simply coming alongside people in a neutral way and enabling them to pursue their own goals. There is a kind of imposition of a sort of folk theory of the good, even in, you know, switching from one default to another. I mean, it's not neutral. You can say that it makes people better off, but it's difficult to say that it's making people do what they really want to do deep down in their souls. I just don't think that's plausible philosophically.
Okay, now let's turn to David Hume, whom I must admit I've never actually read, but I was interested to see what you wrote about him. One particular insight you get from Hume is that it's not achieving our goals that makes us happy, it's setting the goals and pursuing those goals. Now, I've got to say that that does have a certain ring of truth to it for me, but what's the direct relevance of that to the new paternalism?
Well, one, the direct relevance is that much of the new paternalism builds from an understanding of welfare as the satisfaction of a fixed set of preferences. And so we can know if somebody's doing something that runs against their interests because their preferences are fixed. And if they tell us what their preferences are, and then they do something that violates, you know, what they said previously, we know that they're worse off. And so the relevance is that welfare has a dynamic component. It's about becoming rather than satisfying a fixed set of ideas. And if that's the case, then, you know, we might think that we would want to leave people opportunities to develop. Okay. And so that's the economist Robert Sugden has this nice book called The Community of Advantage. And this is essentially one of his ideas about welfare economics. He uses something called the opportunity criteria, that we're not actually sure about the people we'll become in the future. So it's in our interest to preserve opportunities in the future rather than to close doors. Because if if part of your interest lies in becoming, but you don't exactly know who you will become, it doesn't really make sense for you to cut off options in the future. So that's I think, one of the most important takeaways from Hume on this particular point, at least.
Does that also link into something that John Stuart Mill wrote about in On Liberty, where he talks about experiments in living? And one of the things Mill said, or is one of his arguments against paternalism, and against restrictions on free speech, is that paternalistic action by the government sort of weakens people. You know, like free will is a muscle that will only stay strong if it's regularly exercised. And if people are not able effectively to make their own choices, that they will stop being able to be responsible adults, to make sensible mm-hmm. choices of their own. Is that also what Hume was saying?
It is. Hume himself doesn't discuss that so much. But actually, Adam Smith talks at great length about about self-command. He uses this nice phrase, the school of self-command, that we kind of enter into when we go out in the world. And so you could, I don't really make this case much in the essays in the book, but I think it's an important point to be made, that when we continue to sort of rely on the government to tell us what we ought to do, we underdevelop our own critical faculties. When you don't have the, when you don't make errors, you don't have the ability to make error, and you don't feel the cost of those errors, you don't grow as a person. You don't grow in your decision-making capabilities. So that's relevant, I think, for Smith, actually. And it's less emphasized in Hume.
One of the insights from Adam Smith was that there is this sort of the concept of the man within. Can you just explain what he meant by that?
Yeah, he describes moral judgment as involving a kind of artificial separation of your person into an acting self and a judging self. And so when you make a decision, you perceive that situation by sort of abstracting from your acting person and thinking about it sort of critically. And so that's the acting self and the judging self. But the thing is, the judging self is a dynamic being. It's not as if we have one static kind of judging self. Like, our judging self is also sort of groping towards what he thinks his standard of judgment ought to be. So one of the points that I make in the chapter on Smith is that inconsistency, you know, observing somebody who says, I don't want to smoke, and then they smoke, like, that's not a sufficient indication of error, because it could be that the person is just in dialogue with her, you know, judge within. And so inconsistency is very often part of this experiments in living, part of developing our preferences, forming a sense of the kind of person we want to be and the kind of life that we want to live. And that's a very difficult question. Again, we have this sort of folk understanding that we want to, you know, save as much as possible and exercise as much as possible and eat as little sugar as possible. But I think that just is not true, right? And that sort of shrinks down the question of the good life to a very narrow set of criteria.
Yeah, and there's a quote I love from Isaiah Berlin, which I actually quoted in one of my books. This is from Two Concepts of Liberty. You're probably familiar with it. I'll just read it out. I may declare that people are actually aiming at what in their benighted state they consciously resist, because there exists within them an occult entity, their latent rational will, or their true purpose. And that this entity, although it is belied by all that they overtly feel and do and say, is their real self, of which the poor empirical self in space and time may know little or nothing. And that this inner spirit is the only self that deserves to have its wishes taken into account. Once I take this view, I am in a position to ignore the actual wishes of men or societies, to bully, oppress, torture them in the name and on behalf of their real selves, in the secure knowledge that whatever is the true goal of man, happiness, performance of duty, wisdom, a just society, self-fulfillment, must be identical with his freedom, the free choice of his true, albeit often submerged and inarticulate, self. And I think that puts it very well, that once you decide that there's a sort of split personality thing going on, it's just what people say they want to do is the real them, and what they're actually doing and what billions of people are doing in all sorts of ways every day, that's some sort of obscure and unimportant entity. You do, don't you, get a sort of charter for the state to push people around.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a wonderful quote. There's a quote in the book from Hume. It's along kind of similar lines, but more or less he says that, you know, he has this series of essays on kind of four different perspectives on the good life. And in the final of those essays, which is called The Skeptic, you know, in The Voice of the Skeptic, he says all of these philosophers have been guilty of basically imposing their ideals onto everyone else. They formulate some notion of the good, and they think everybody deep down has this kind of notion of the good. And I think Hume actually has a deep political message in these essays, which is that if you sort of view the world and you think, well, we know deep down exactly what people want, then that is sort of a path to oppression and wars of religion and totalitarianism, which is the specific point that he was making. In the case of, you know, this sort of new paternalism, the path is towards basically, well, you could say totalitarianism in a sense, but certainly a very robust nanny state and the prohibition of so-called vices and sort of like sins of consumption. Because we know deep down, or they claim that they know, that people really don't want to partake of addictive substances or sugar or trans fat. And in fact, people would be better off if we just banned them completely. That's some of the endpoint that we've seen, both in scholarship and, of course, in actual policy.
Yeah, and that's sort of the position of Sarah Connolly, who is a pretty explicit hard paternalist. She's a philosopher also from America who wrote a book called Against Autonomy some years ago, which you also mentioned in your book. And I read that when it came out. And I have to say, I do admire her for being explicitly paternalistic, although even she would say that she's only a means paternalist rather than an ends paternalist. And maybe I should explain for the viewers that the writing about paternalism, writers on paternalism, they make a distinction between means paternalists and ends paternalists. So a means paternalist is, for example, if I really want to give up smoking and I tell my wife to hide my cigarettes, that's means paternalism. She's just helping me do something which I'm asking for. Whereas an ends paternalist would hide your cigarettes even if you've got no intention and express no desire to start smoking. They've just decided what your ends should be. They've decided what your goals in life should be, and they're going to basically force them upon you whether or not you want them. And it strikes me that the problem with Connolly's argument, because she just claims to be a means paternalist, but she does this on the basis of essentially surveys in which people say, I'd like to lose weight, I'd like to stop smoking, I'd like to save more money for old age. And she treats those stated preferences as absolutes, as their only real preferences. Whereas economists tend not to do that. They tend to look only at what people are actually doing, partly because talk is cheap, but also because there's the social desirability bias, but people have second order preferences. They want to be this type of person who wants to eat less or smoke less, but they're not actually that person. But also because it ignores completely the issue of trade-offs. So people can have two or more completely mutually incompatible aspirations in life. And so, most people probably do want to lose weight. Most people are overweight in Western countries. But people also want to eat, triple cheese pizzas and not do a lot of exercise. And so when you've got this kind of clash between people's aspirations, it seems to me that there's only one person who can really decide what the priority is. And so rather than asking people things in surveys, maybe we should just trust what they do as being, at that moment in time at least, being what they really want to do.
Yeah, it's also, there's an important bias that I think is true, which is social desirability bias, which is when you ask somebody something, they'll tend to report what they think is the socially desirable thing, which suggests that if you ask people, do you want to smoke? Even if they really might want to smoke, they say, no, of course not. Everyone knows smoking is bad. So that's one issue just sort of empirically, which relates to the stated versus revealed preferences. I lost my train of thought. But I don't tend to think that many of those survey results are that reliable. Oh, the other thing I was going to say is that it does avoid trade-offs. It also avoids, radical future uncertainty. Like I might think, well, it would be really great to be healthy and live a long life. But if I'm unsure, politically, geopolitically, what will happen in the next 15 years, it might be entirely reasonable for me to think I'll trade off some of my, future vitality against the present enjoyment of tobacco or trans fats. That's not unreasonable at all.
Yeah, sometimes you hear behavioral economists talk about hyperbolic discounting and, saying that we know that people are irrational because they put more weight on present pleasures rather than the risks in the future or the pleasures in the future. But actually, a lot of the time when they talk about supposed hyperbolic discounting, they're actually just talking about discounting, which is completely rational. And you absolutely should put more weight on the present than on the future, not least because there's a chance you might not be around in 30 or 40 or 50 years. So that's not hyperbolic discounting. That's just discounting, right?
Right, right. Yeah, that's right. And again, with hyperbolic discounting, You know, the interesting thing is, so if you observe like time inconsistency, I say that, well, I'd really like to exercise and I'm going to go to bed early and I'm going to wake up and go to the gym tomorrow. Then tomorrow I sleep in. Like, on which end did I err? Did I err in thinking that what I really wanted was to go exercise, or did I err in sleeping in too late? So there is a time inconsistency, and you can see that in hyperbolic discounting, but it's not immediately clear which of the two positions represents my so-called true preferences. And the assumption has always been, well, of course, it's the me that wants to go to the gym that represents what I really want. It can't possibly be the me that wants to sleep in and enjoy the pleasure of a Saturday morning. But that assumption, right, is sort of predicated on this folk theory of the good. Like, it's not tending to what I specifically want necessarily.
There's a very interesting experiment that David Halpern mentions in his book about all this kind of stuff. Now, Halpern was the head of the Behavioral Insights team, popularly known as the Nudge Unit. And in his book, he gives this example, yet another kind of psychological experiment carried out on students somewhere in America, like most of them are, probably not replicated like most of them are. But the experiment was very simple. They got a group of students who were going to have a party in a week's time. And they said, what would you like to eat? What movie would you like to watch? And when they were looking 7 days down the road, they would tend to pick quite healthy foods, salads and so on, and they would tend to pick quite highbrow movies. But then when they did exactly the same experiment, but the party was going to be, now, they tended to pick chocolate cake and chips and Sleepless in Seattle. Now, Halpern uses this as evidence that the people are irrational, and the people who had the party there and then were not pursuing their real preferences. But it seems to me to show the exact opposite. It shows that if you if you take this kind of time lag out, because anybody can imagine that they're going to be a slightly different person in 7 days' time. But if you actually say, no, here and now, this is the choice. Do you want to do this or do you want to do this? Then it's what they actually pick there and then that is the real choice. And in actual fact, in 7 days' time, they might have been a bit reluctant to have picked the things they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think social desirability bias also probably plays a role there. When you're taking a survey, you think, well, this is the kind of person I want to portray myself as. Whereas what you really might want is to, stay at home and eat a bag of chips and watch a comedy.
Yeah, second order preferences. So people are really saying that they wish they were the kind of person who preferred salad and highbrow films, but they're not, and this is the thing, or people who, I wish I was the kind of person who didn't want to smoke. I mean, smoking is a very interesting one because I fully accept there's an addictive nature to nicotine that does kind of set it apart from some of these other issues. But even with smoking, if you anti-smoking campaigners always say some huge number of smokers wish they'd never started or want to quit now. And they're saying it at the moment as we were debating this new tobacco prohibition bill, and they'll say, 80-90% of virtually all smokers want to quit. Actually, if you look at the surveys, reasons we've already discussed, surveys are not always the best way of getting a window into somebody's soul. But the surveys show about 45% of people in Britain who smoke say they want to quit. But you then ask them, have you actually tried quitting in the last year? It's a lot smaller number. If you ask them, are you intending to quit in the next 3 months? It's a lot smaller number. Even if you just ask them if they really want to quit, and this is something they actually do in the survey, they said, no. Well, they say, do you want to quit? And they'll say, do you really, in capital letters, want to quit? And then that drops down to about 20%. I think it does come back to this question, doesn't it? Of, how do we actually know what people want?
Yeah, I think that's the key question. And I'm glad that, at least some of the new paternalists have sort of become more openly paternalistic. Cass Sunstein, for instance, in some of his more recent work says, we should respect agency, but agency and welfare don't always go together. And when they diverge, we should promote welfare over agency. That is, sometimes we just have to say that people don't know what's good for them. And I appreciate that honesty, even though I disagree with the position. Similarly, with Sarah Connolly, this idea that, hard paternalism actually is beneficial because people just do dumb things all the time. That's more upfront, and it's something that I object to, but it's still, I think, better than pretending that we can really just sort of in a benign, neutral way impose these regulations that help people really do what they want. And I think that's very dangerous language, and it's very undemocratic. And there's all sorts of political problems with that.
Is it fair to say that the nudge agenda has never really got the political cut through and pickup that perhaps some people thought at the time when it was being discussed as being sort of the third way in policy making? You know, I've given the example of the opt-in pension scheme, but aside from that, it's not easy to think of that many nudges that have been acted on by politicians. And not only that, but you've had this replication crisis in psychology, which has discredited a lot of the research that the behavioral economic stuff was based on. But it seems to me the nudge agenda has never really been picked up that much by politicians.
I don't know if it's been picked up by politicians, but I do think it's sort of been just added to the toolkit of the regulator. So I'm not sure that there are many, at least in the U.S., regulators who think, oh, what we're going to do is make people better off as judged by their own standards. I think it's now just sort of a new set of techniques that can be used to make existing regulations more effective. And there are, I do think, some exceptions, some financial regulations, proposed regulations of overdraft protection in the U.S. or credit card regulations or energy efficiency regulations. So I do think it has had an effect, but I also think more broadly that behavioral science has just been sort of accepted and into the fold of current regulation making.
We're nearly out of time. I just want to ask you one more question, which is, did Hume or Smith ever directly address the issue of paternalism head on?
Well, I think Smith was a very anti-paternalistic thinker. Smith really thought that ordinary people were intelligent, much more intelligent than other people thought that they were, much more intelligent than, well, some philosophers and some policy-making experts. The Wealth of Nations, in a way, is a kind of defense of ordinary intelligence and the sort of positive effects of letting people pursue their interests in their own way. And if you look at Smith's policy recommendations, they're consistently anti-paternalistic. Even when he advocates for government interventions, he never does so in a paternalistic way. That is, he never does so by saying, well, these people are really doing things that are making, you know, that are making making them worse off. It's more about, you know, exceptions for national security or different kinds of regulations on banks. But it's not paternalistic at all. So that's I think, fair to say about Smith. And Hume, I don't think, was a paternalist, but he didn't, off the top of my head, I can't think about him addressing it in any way, except in the essays that I discuss in the final chapter of the book, where, again, he says, look, you have all these people with theories of the good, and they're trying to impose them on everybody else, but they aren't self-reflective. They don't realize that the answer to the question, what is the good life, is a chatter. It's not, you know, a single formulation. So in that sense, you know, you could say he's anti-paternalistic as well.
That is very interesting. Well, I really need to go off and read some David Hume now. Folks at home, you need to go off and download this book, which you can do from the IEA website, iea.org.uk. While you're there, you can also make a donation to the IEA if you're feeling generous. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another Swift Half. I hope you will tune in then. Eric, thank you very much, and goodbye, everybody.